Support comes from Empower Missouri's Affordable Housing Coalition, working to address the causes of housing insecurity and homelessness through tenant advocacy. Information at empowermissouri.org/housing.
Missouri is now the epicenter in the COVID-19 pandemic, primarily due to the spread of the Delta variant, and few places in the state have been as hard hit as Southwest Missouri. Republican State Senator Lincoln Huff joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about the impact of the Delta variant on his constituents and what political leaders should do to try to stop the spread. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me is my guest host today, St. Louis Public Radio's health reporter,
Sarah Fenton. Hi, friends.
And joining us from Springfield, Missouri, he is the state senator for Missouri's 30th district.
Lincoln Huff. Thanks for having me on, Jason. Sarah, nice to hear from you.
Hi.
Thank you for coming on today. We have a lot of important issues to talk about, and most importantly, the COVID-19 pandemic, which has been raging in Southwest Missouri. Senator, I want to just ask a very simple question for you, maybe to be more informed about the situation from my perspective in St. Louis. What is the situation on the ground in Southwest Missouri, and just how dire is it?
Well, so I've been in contact with both of our major hospitals down here. We've got Cox, and also the Mercy system has a large hospital here in Springfield. The situation is this, Jason. Our hospitals are either at capacity or very near capacity on any given day. If you follow, you know, the Twitter messages from some of our hospital administration, they send out a lot of kind of dashboard readouts about how many patients they've got in their COVID wards, how many new cases are showing up in our community. And it's a very real and dire situation down here. We've had meetings with some federal agencies about an alternative care site in the event that our hospitals actually do reach full capacity. Some patients have actually been transferred to other hospitals throughout the state, because if you're in a long-term care facility, a lot of those facilities right now, Jason, have policies in place that they, even after a person maybe doesn't need the on-site medical treatment 24/7, they don't necessarily want them returning back to those long-term care facilities in the event that they could still be contagious and spread it to other residents in those facilities. So it's a real situation down here. I mean, I get updates from not just our health department folks, but also the hospitals every day. And the message that I've been trying to get out, and I know our mayor was actually on Face the Nation a couple of weeks ago. I know the mayor of Kansas City was on last week. I did Chris Hayes' show on MSNBC last week, and my message is simple, and I hope people hear it. If you haven't been vaccinated yet, go get vaccinated. If you're apprehensive about those shots or the side effects or something you've heard or something you've read, I would beg people to talk to a trusted healthcare provider. Talk to your family doctor. Talk to those healthcare professionals that you've known, or maybe your kids have, been at the pediatrician for years. Talk to them, call them, talk to those nurses in those offices, and get their opinions, get your questions answered, and then make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And we're hearing that messaging over and over every day. I'm a health reporter. I hear it every day. What can elected officials do to help people get vaccinated beyond just saying, you know, get vaccinated, it's the right thing to do? Or is it even an elected official's responsibility, and or is it more of an individual responsibility?
Well, ultimately, I guess the decision relies lies completely on the individual and what they believe is necessary for themselves and their families and their friends and their loved ones and all that. I guess I see my role as an elected official as sometimes I have a little bit of a pulpit to speak from. Our Springfield news leader down here about 2 weeks ago on a Sunday paper ran a spread on the front page, and it was just pictures of, you know, who they kind of deemed, you know, community leaders. They had faith leaders on there. They had our new superintendent of our public schools. They had hospital folks. And the message was, please get vaccinated. We have one of the lower vaccination rates in our community right now, a little over 40%. Mm-hmm. And you know, the point there is, as this thing, as this virus changes, the numbers show that the folks that are not vaccinated are the ones that end up in the hospitals with more severe circumstances and require more care. Now, you know, not saying that if you get a vaccine, you'll not get COVID anymore, but everyone that I've talked to that has received a vaccine and then test positive later on has very mild symptoms. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked to Steve Edwards at one of our hospitals down here at Cox a few weeks ago, and he told me that it's pretty simple when you look at the numbers and, you know, who's being admitted to his hospital. 90%+ of those COVID patients have not received any vaccine, either the first or second shots. Mm-hmm. That's kind of hard to argue with.
Yeah. What do you think about vaccine incentives? Last week, we saw Governor Parson announced the vaccine lottery, where 900 people are getting $10,000 each if they have been vaccinated, or they're entered into a raffle. They're all not getting it. But,
right. And I'm sure elected officials are somehow carved out of that, right?
I know. I looked up. There are a couple carves out, unfortunately.
Right, but, right.
What's your take on that? Do you think that could be an effective tool? Do you think it'll make a difference here in Missouri?
Well, you've seen, Sarah, you've seen other states do this, whether it's just cash prizes or whether it's, you know, tickets to, you know, sporting events, things mm-hmm. like that. There's been a lot of those incentive programs. In fact, Missouri State down here has an incentive program. I believe it's either one or two semesters. You can be entered into a drawing to win free tuition to Missouri State for either a semester or I think maybe a full year.
Right. So, that's not a small thing.
That's not a small thing. Exactly. Now, I'll say this. I think it's sad that that's where we are, that we have to actually come up with some sort of a cash prize to try to talk people into doing the right thing. I think it's interesting that that's where we are now as a society. Mm-hmm. But if this is what we need to do to get these numbers up and to, you know, help curb that burden on our healthcare providers, because one of the things that I don't know that a lot of people are talking about just yet is, how about the burnout in the individuals that have been working in these hospitals and in these clinics for now, what, 18 months, 16 months, and just the sheer toll that that takes on individuals, not just, you know, mentally and emotionally, but physically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, that bothers me, I guess, a little bit is this idea that if I don't want to get a vaccine, I don't have to get a vaccine, and that's fine. But how about all the people that are going to end up taking care of you if you do end up landing in the hospital? How about all the people that have been, you know, fighting to keep individuals alive? I mean, like I said, I'm not sure that I'll get every one of these statistics right, but I believe the Cox system lost 15 individuals since last weekend to COVID. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people. I mean, these are people. And the sad thing is that I talk to people every single day who start to change their mindset when a friend or a loved one all of a sudden becomes gravely ill.
Yeah, and Senator, not to interrupt, but I want to play a clip now from Governor Parson, who is making that exact point.
I'm going to tell you, I just from personal experience, I want to say, from living in a community of Southwest Missouri that's down there in that, when some of those people in your community start ending up in a hospital, people start, unfortunately, paying a little more attention. Or somebody gets sick and maybe necessarily not in a hospital. But it's unfortunate that that's a little bit of a game changer for some people, but it is. So again, I think by us going out there trying to promote how important the vaccine is, and to make sure that you understand, you may not be the ones going to go to the hospital. There'll be a lot of people that won't, but you're the one that's spreading it.
So have you found that the governor's statement is actually bearing fruit, that more people are getting the vaccine now because they realize that it's a grave danger to themselves and their families?
Yeah, I think that's accurate, Jason. I hadn't heard that specific clip from the governor, but I mean, I'm saying the exact same thing. And, you know, I guess almost anecdotally, he and I are hearing the same thing out of our communities. And it is a game changer for people. And again, it's sort of a sad fact, but I guess if that's what changes the opinion of individuals and gets them showing up at a clinic, then that's where we are. Now, you asked, Sarah, I think you asked earlier, what else can, you know, elected officials do? There's a bipartisan group of legislators down here in Southwest Missouri in my community that are actually hosting a vaccine clinic this coming Saturday. And, you know, the information's, you know, getting out there in our community, and we're speaking with a collective voice, Republicans and Democrats. Myself, Betsy Fogel, one of our new representatives, actually spearheaded this and came up with the idea, and props to her, because this is exactly what we need to be doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we've got a site in place. We've got people that are going to administer the vaccines. We've got the basketball coach from Missouri State coming over, doing a little PR with us at the event. And so I think that's something we can do, because what I want people to hear is that I understand this has become a political issue.
Yeah.
It's not a political issue to me.
Right. And that leads right into
wearing a mask. Yeah. Isn't a political issue to me. Sorry. Go ahead,
no,
Sarah.
That's okay. No. Well, you're just sort of,
sometimes I do a really dramatic pause.
No, it's leading right into my next question, which, as sure, you know, I don't have to tell you that the response to COVID has become more and more politicized as we've gone on. And so what responsibilities does the GOP in particular have to not cater to people who are spouting misinformation and, you know, other nonsense about how safe the vaccine is or how unsafe it is?
Mm-hmm. So my opinion is that I don't think it necessarily lies with, you know, just one party or just one media outlet or just one social media platform or anything like that. I think, you know, ultimately people need to make this decision. The thing that I just keep saying, and I want people to hear, is that if you're apprehensive about it, don't just look at social media. Don't mm-hmm. just look, you know, at Facebook and at Twitter and things like that, where anyone can say and post anything with no background, no basis, no research. You can just say it. It's your platform. And then, sadly, some people say, well, I read this, and turns out you're going to grow 3 heads if you get a vaccine. Well, maybe you ought to call someone who works in the healthcare field. Maybe, I mean, I'm fortunate, probably. I've got 2 brothers that are doctors, and, you know, we talked about this early on, and, you know, I said, look, you know, talk to the physicians that you use, talk to your pediatricians that your kids go to, and get their opinions, and make a decision for yourself there.
Mm-hmm. Would you?
I don't like.
Oh, sorry, continue, Senator.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't necessarily like, you know, blaming. You know, assigning blame in something like this. I think we as a community down here in Southwest Missouri, we as a society need to come together and say, let's get past the partisanship here. Let's get past, you know, one side or the other trying to tell someone what to do, and let's just get real and factual information out there. And that's why, like I said, when Representative Fogel came up with this idea, I said, this is perfect. Mm-hmm. And we got a handful of Republican representatives to sign on. And the minority leader in the Democratic Party in the House, Crystal Quaid, she's from down here, she's signed on. That's what we need to do. Mm-hmm. We need to speak with a collective voice and say this is bigger than your political views.
Now you mentioned collective blame, and I want to be clear when I make this statement that there are sometimes very real reason for vaccine hesitancy. Let's just say that you took a medication when you were younger that was not good for you. You're not going to trust doctors as much as people that haven't been in that situation. Or if you're a Black person who has been let down historically by the medical establishment for centuries, yeah, I would have some hesitation about doctors saying that a vaccine is safe and effective too. But what, as a vaccinated person that has done a lot of things right, not saying I've done everything right over the last 18 months, mm-hmm. but who has tried to follow the rules to keep my family safe, it is tremendously frustrating when I see on Twitter that, you know, masks are coming back or that restrictions are coming or that, you know, God forbid, the schools may not have in-person learning anymore, primarily because a lot of people are making the wrong decision not to get vaccinated. Are you also hearing frustration from people like me who don't want to go back to where we were 6, 7, 8 months ago, but we're kind of going toward that direction because a lot of people aren't doing the right thing and getting vaccinated?
Sure. Sure. And this is the part, probably where I'm a little too real on this stuff. It's maddening to me. It is maddening to me that people will take something as the gospel truth that they hear, you know, online somewhere or on a social media platform from someone who has no basis or no understanding or no background in what they're saying. It is incredibly frustrating. And Jason, I hear exactly what you're saying, because I feel like I'm in the same situation as you are. I feel like I have done, and my family has done, what we have deemed necessary to try to keep ourselves and our loved ones and our extended family safe. My family didn't get together for last Christmas. You know, my boys didn't get to hang out with their cousins on Christmas like we always do.
I watched my sister get married via Zoom, Senator.
And I canceled my wedding.
Yeah, yeah. We've all made sacrifices.
I mean, yeah, no. That's why it is frustrating.
Right. I mean, my first grader didn't spend a day in a classroom last year.
Yeah.
I mean, these kids today, they say, "You remember when we used to go to school?"
Oh.
You know, I mean, it's like, it's just like, it like rips your heart out.
Baby.
And so we've done what we have decided as a family, right? And it, to keep each other safe. And the fact that a large number of people have said, you know, "You're essentially not going to tell me what to do," is incredibly frustrating. Now, Jason, I think you're exactly right. Well, you know, when you mention, you don't know what someone's medical background is.
Right.
You don't know what someone's been through. And so that's another thing that I think a lot of us need to keep aware of. You don't know if, you know, someone had a bad experience at a hospital or, yeah, had a bad reaction to a drug one time and now they're, you know, a little bit more apprehensive than someone who has a fairly clean medical history, you know, something like that. So it's important to try to remember other people's perspective, but at the same time, just defiance is kind of the word that comes to mind, the utter defiance of the idea that this is going to be good for our overall community is wildly frustrating to me.
Right. And that's something that we saw yesterday. It was big national news. St. Louis and St. Louis County decided to bring back mask mandates after, mm-hmm. I think, about 2 months, because they're worried that the cases are starting to rise and the hospitalizations are starting to rise. Would you recommend that people mask up now? What do you think of these city and county mask mandates?
Well, one issue with mask mandates is they're incredibly hard to enforce.
True.
Right. I mean, like it just, I mean, and we saw that we had, you know, our community went through that like so many other communities around the state and around the country for a long period of time. I guess the thing, Sarah, that's that I would go back to is before we had a vaccine that was, you know, fairly effective, quite frankly, before we had a vaccine, we were kind of fighting this thing blind. And so we made decisions in our communities with the best information that we had. And at the time, I mean, we've got case studies down here where, you know, where a hair salon, an individual who was COVID positive and was actually at work, didn't know it, but was wearing a mask. And none of the patrons to that hair salon ended up contracting COVID from this individual. So there is evidence that these things work. I guess the thing that's hard to understand right now is that we have a vaccine that does work also, but since so many people have made the decision thus far not to take it, our communities are back in this situation. And that's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back after this quick break with State Senator Lincoln Hoff.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on the Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Senator Lincoln Hoff. He is a Republican from Springfield. I want to shift gears to another major story that broke last week, and that's the Missouri Supreme Court unanimously deciding that the 2020 Medicaid expansion amendment was valid and that the state has to start signing up and enrolling people who are in the Medicaid expansion population. That's 138% of the federal poverty level. It's about $17,800 for an individual, maybe around $24,000 for like a single mother or father of one. I know, Senator, that you had taken a little bit different approach to this than some of your Republican colleagues. First of all, I want you to explain that. And more importantly, what do you think the legislature is going to do next based off of this decision?
All right. Yeah. So, Jason, so I'm the guy, I'm the vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. And for the most part, the chairman and I see things fairly similarly. This was an issue that we were kind of on polar opposites on. And I'm the individual that, you know, during our budget markup this last year, drafted the amendment to our appropriations bills to go ahead and fund, albeit a slightly more conservative financial obligation for the Medicaid expanded population than what the governor had put in his budget. But at least in my opinion, I saw it as this was put on the ballot. 61-62% of voters statewide said we support it. My opinion was that at that point, we needed to do what the voters of the state had asked us to do. Ultimately, that got defeated at a 7-7 tie in our appropriations committee, and then did not have the will of the entire Senate body. The House never did put it in their budget, but we had a long discussion on the Senate floor and didn't have the votes get it done there either. So all that being said, yes, I do differ a little bit probably with a number of Republicans in this regard, mainly because I think when something's put on the ballot and the voters of the state say we support this, the legislature should listen to them. And it's not always going to be, you know, what we want. But in my opinion, there's a reason that we have the ballot initiative process in the state. And, you know, this is an issue, Jason. I mean, I've been in Jefferson City for, you know, almost a decade now. And this has been something that has been talked about and argued over by Republicans and Democrats for the better part of a decade. And I believe what you got into was the voters of the state saying, we think this is the right thing to do and we're going to support it. So it was a little frustrating that we didn't end up getting that done in the legislative session this last year. But given a unanimous now Supreme Court decision, you know, citing that this is constitutional and these individuals will now be enrolled, the next question is, when and how much does it cost us, right? Mm-hmm. So the Senate has had a couple of calls. We were supposed to have a call yesterday that ended up getting canceled. But, you know, I think the question at hand is, you know, is when do we do this, not if we do this. Now, you know as well as I do that there will still be individuals that say, well, the court didn't exactly direct us to fund it, so we still don't have to. And I guess my message to those people is and will be, stop being cute about this. Okay. I mean, in my opinion, I understand, and I've read the Constitution, that, you know, when a ballot initiative is put forward and there's no funding mechanism, there's, you know, ambiguity, in my opinion, about whether or not then that will go into effect. What you have now is a unanimous Supreme Court decision saying it is constitutional, so we will need to fund it. And I think the best thing that we can do is start enrolling these individuals and then see where those numbers end up. I mean, that, you know, that's the trick about this is, you know, how many people are going to enroll in this expanded population, Jason? How many, I mean, are you, you know, the rough numbers I always use are somewhere between 200 and 250,000 people, mm-hmm. but we don't know just yet, right? And so it would be probably a little premature, in my opinion, to come in, you know, next week in a special session and say, we need to appropriate money. Now, on the money side of things, and you guys can interrupt me whenever you want. I'm in the Senate, so we're just used to talking. On the money side of things, we put about $500 million in a Medicaid stabilization fund during last year, appropriations process. What we did not do was give the spending authority to that money, okay? So mm-hmm. we set the money aside, but if we want to pull those federal dollars and utilize those for this expanded population, we're going to have to pass an appropriation spending authority bill out of that pile of money. Mm-hmm. We've got $2.5 billion of general revenue sitting in the bank right now. Mm-hmm. So, and our Medicaid system, our program is, you know, over $11 billion of the state budget all in. So we're not going to run out of money in September or October or something like that. So my opinion really would be, we're all back up there in September for veto session anyway. Let's see kind of where the uptick is on enrolling these individuals, and then we'll have a better idea of how much money we're talking about.
So given that we have, you know, all of this money just sort of sitting there waiting to be used, does it make sense to focus on creating a permanent funding stream for Medicaid expansion? And if so, what would that be coming from? Would it be medical mm-hmm. marijuana? Would it be managed care organizations? Like, talk about how to make this sort of a perpetual,
somewhat sustainable.
Yeah,
sustainable. So here's some good news. There is, for states that have not yet expanded their Medicaid population, there is, I call it a 5% kicker. Right now that federal match is a 90-10 for the most part. The feds pick up 90% of this Medicaid reimbursement to providers. The state pays 10. Mm-hmm. On top of that, for states, like I said, that have not expanded this Medicaid population yet, there is a 5% bonus on top of that. Now, rough math for the state of Missouri, an extra 5% is about $52 million. Now, it's not forever. It's for 24 months. But $50 million for 2 years is $1 billion.
Yeah, that's from the American Rescue Plan. And what I have thought is you could use that money to pay for the state match for several years while you figure out a way to permanently pay for the state match, if there even is a state match, because there's a lot of analysts who think you can move people who are currently on Medicaid into the 90% 10 match, and the state match may be negligible by the time all of that money is gone. Now, there are other people who disagree with that, but is that kind of your thought process about making this sustainable going forward?
Yeah, what I would like to do is I would like to take that money and sort of what we did with the $500 million for the Medicaid Stabilization Fund, I would like to see us take that $50 to $52 million a month and put it aside for this expanded population to do exactly what you're saying, Jason, which is pay for this in a multi-year ongoing way that essentially takes, you know, the burden of the state off the table. Now, the next thing that, you know, that we need to talk about here, and there's actually the committee that was formed after the FRA special session finished, that is now looking, I think Senator Bill White out of the Joplin area is chairing it, but they're looking at, Medicaid reforms, because when you have a $11+ billion program in the state, there's probably some things, and I think everyone would agree, there's probably some things that we can do better. And so Senator White's leading up a committee that's looking into that. So I think that's also part of the conversation. Instead of just where is all of the money going to come from, are there reforms? And I mean, I know we all know Director Todd Richardson, and I think there's no better guy to have at the helm to help work through some of those reform measures than Todd, just because he's got a good background in, in a lot of different policy areas. So the reform side of it is the next part of that equation. Mm-hmm. The funding, in my opinion, I've not run the numbers out further than about 6 or 7 years, but there's enough federal money coming into the state right now that our burden as a state, as you said, is almost negligible for the next 6, 7, 8 years.
Yeah. I want to play a clip now from State Representative Tony Lovasco. He's a Republican from St. Charles County who gave his opinion about what is next for the legislature after this decision.
It seems like a lot of folks on the left are arguing that, like, well, now we are being forced to pay, and like it's game over, it's all done, and it's resolved. And a lot of folks on the right are basically saying, oh, well, the activist judges are forcing our hand. Well, really neither of those things is accurate. So it'll probably be a good, few weeks, I would imagine, before it kind of sinks in and people kind of really wrap their heads around what's going on. But I do agree that really, I don't think all that much has changed by this ruling. I think ultimately when we voted not to appropriate the money, I think we did so with the understanding that, the constitutional amendment did pass. There are some amounts of obligations that come with that, and the particulars can be worked out, but ultimately this is about whether or not the legislature has the power of the purse, and I think it's pretty clear that the Supreme Court said we do.
I think that Representative Lovasco is 100% right. There is nothing in this decision that forces the legislature to do anything as far as providing more money to Medicaid, but I want you to give your take about what will happen if the legislature does nothing and doesn't provide mm-hmm. authority for Medicaid expansion population to be paid for.
Right. And so this is sort of an argument that I've made for the last year and a half as this, this Medicaid expansion conversation has continued to morph into this. I don't want, as a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, I do not want to delegate my appropriation authority to a judge somewhere. And my fear is if we keep pushing this, that is exactly what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And then there are a multitude of programs throughout the state, funding mechanisms throughout the state, formulas, quite frankly, throughout our appropriations that we don't always adhere to, Jason. And if you go down this road of saying, we will not, we will not, we will not, until we are forced by a judge to fund something, when will it stop? Mm-hmm. Because then my fear is anyone who is part of a formula in the state that is not being adhered to, even though there's that little language there at the bottom that says, as appropriated, I'm worried about if we just continue to push this thing and then you get a judge that says, okay, fine, if you're just not going to appropriate the money, I'm going to tell you you have to, and now you have to. And then we have delegated our appropriation authority to someone else. Mm-hmm.
In the last couple of minutes that we have left, one of the other things you're going to be doing as a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee is deciding where $2.8 billion of American Rescue Plan money should go. What have been the discussions about where your colleagues want to spend that money? I could imagine some of it may go to, roads and bridges. Some of it might go toward rural broadband, sewer repair, fixing lead pipes. I've also heard about overhauling the state's IT system. Are those kind of the things that you're hearing about where that money is going to go when it's eventually appropriated?
Yeah, I think yes, and I think the conventional wisdom on that few billion dollars is that we need to be cognizant that this is not an ongoing forever sort of appropriation line. You know, when Sarah asked earlier about, you know, making this expanded Medicaid population a little more sustainable ongoing, I think it's important to remember that in this instance, I see these as one-time dollars, and I'm always very cautious when you get one-time dollars and someone comes in and says, I've got this ongoing thing that I need to hire 50 people for, and it's going to be great. But as the appropriator on my side, I say, where is that money going to come from when the one-time money is gone? So the things that you just outlined, you know, the broadband build out throughout the state of Missouri, we still have a handful of public schools in this state, quite frankly, that are not on high-speed internet.
Hmm.
And if the last year has shown us anything, it's that our educational facilities are going to have to be pretty nimble in the future. Hope that we never have to go through something like this again. But if we do, I don't want a student in a rural district having to drive to their, you know, city library and sit in the parking lot to do their lessons because, you know, their school or their community doesn't have high speed internet. So I think that's a great avenue to build out on kind of a one time basis. The other thing you mentioned is the state IT system. You know, it's always interesting to me, Jason, that, you know, we can throw tens of millions of dollars into the state IT system almost every year, and it's always still broken. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, the deal is it's so big. It's just, and we all know, everyone out here in the world knows that as soon as you get a new laptop, you know, 2 months down the road, there's a newer laptop that's faster and better and all the stuff. Right. So the state has for decades, in my opinion, not invested the necessary capital in building out those IT systems. And before people think, well, that's just like a huge waste of money, remember that those are the systems that when you go down to your Department of Motor Vehicle office and you're frustrated because they're, you know, hand keying in something that takes 5 minutes and they ought to be able to, you know, scan something and it be done in 3 seconds. It's because that IT system behind the person that you're standing there talking to is, you know, was built in the 80s. So there are a lot of investments like that that we can make on a kind of a one-time basis to improve the customer service output that this state has.
We'll be following those issues very closely, and we will also be following the COVID situation in Missouri extremely closely. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can find all of our stories at stlpr.org. You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. You can follow Sarah on Twitter at
@petite_smudge.
How can people follow you on Twitter or any other parts of the World Wide Web, Senator?
Yeah, Jason, Sarah, thanks for having me on. Appreciate the discussion. Appreciate what you guys are doing in getting information out there. You can always follow me on Twitter at Lincoln P. Huff at Twitter.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.